Hello, and welcome to Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else,
a series of conversations with innovative educators at colleges and universities across the country and around the world.
This podcast is produced by faculty and staff in the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development at Xavier University of Louisiana.
And now, let's talk about teaching, learning, and everything else.
My name is Marcia Chatlin, and I'm an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown. I started my career in the Honors College at the University of Oklahoma. And I think that for me, I take very seriously the idea that in my role as a faculty member, I need to be as committed to my research as my teaching and as committed to my teaching as I am to my research. And so one of the things that I think is really important for scholars is the ways that we think about our research on a trajectory as something that evolves and that we always have to recreate and push ourselves. I feel very much about teaching. And so I really try to think about practices, whether it's with technology or changing the ways that I connect with students or even revising the kinds of assignments that I generate in a class. I really think of my teaching as part of an evolution, professional evolution, as well as reflective of this, the different ways that students understand themselves and the context in which they're in college.
Right. We have a member of our faculty and administration here, Sister Monica, who talks about how you have to meet the students where they are.
Absolutely.
Which I think is a really important thing. And to that end, I think your podcast does such an incredible job of doing that, your podcast, Office Hours, which I've been listening to. I'm trying to catch up with all of the episodes, but not quite there yet, but I've listened to quite a few. And I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit more about how that came about and what drove you to do it.
So Office Hours is a pure labor of love. It's not something that really is prominent on my CV or, you know, I can use it for my annual review. So I started the podcast. I live in Washington, D.C., and I don't really drive anymore. I walk most places or take public transportation, so I listen to a lot of podcasts. And for a long time, I was just a fan of public radio, public radio streaming casts of shows that I missed the first time. And I like a lot of people, spent more and more time listening to things like Serial and Startup and the stuff from Gimlet Media. And I actually really just appreciated the form, the fact that in a moment where we can be so stimulated visually by the things that we have on television and online, that this was a medium that really was about letting people in to an intimate conversation that's had among people. And I thought that was really nice. And so I wanted to kind of just experiment with the genre. And I was also developing the idea for Office Hours during a time where I felt like a lot of my students, particularly of my students of color, were really feeling invisible and not legible to a lot of people at universities. And so I wanted to kind of give just my colleagues the opportunity to get to know students in a different way and to really model the importance of creating trusting relationships with students outside of the classroom as a way to kind of build your own teaching and mentoring practices. And I think it's a great opportunity for students to talk about who they are in this very specific moment of their lives. And it kind of serves as a time capsule for students who appeared on the first few episodes. I think when they listen back, they think, oh, I sound so young. Or some of the students, you know, talk about some goals and some of them were able to achieve them. And others, you know, they found a different path. And so I really like capturing why I love teaching so much and why I love students so much, and to be able to share that with people who are on either side of that conversation.
Yeah, I think that really, really comes through, both the students having this opportunity to talk and to share, but you being able to kind of expand upon what you love about teaching and your love for the students and their success is really kind of contagious. But I imagine this must take a fair amount of your time. And I know you said it's a labor of love, but What are some of the biggest challenges you've encountered keeping up a podcast and keeping motivated to do it every, I guess, week?
So the way I do the podcast, just from a practicality standpoint, is for the first season when we were experimenting, one of the things that we do is we record a lot of content and then we make the shows. And that helps a lot with maximizing free time. So for season two, I focused on students who are in the Truman Scholarship Program. I've been a mentor for Truman Scholars for a really long time. And so they were all here this summer.
Okay.
So I decided X amount of time would be spent on interviewing. And so I would, you know, interview four students back to back in the sound booth, right? And with those interviews, me and the producer, Alex Tyson, we can do the content around it, whether it's us bantering, whether it's the advice. So just from like a practicality standpoint, because our podcast is so thematic and not necessarily responsive to current events. And you can kind of hear it sometimes, like a podcast will come out in December and we're talking about how hot it is, right? So I get less concerned about that as long as I'm touching upon the issues that I think stay consistent in the college experience, navigating relationships with parents, navigating, you know, shifting expectations of yourself, ideas about success, you know, transferring. And so just from a time standpoint, we make a lot of the episodes in advance and then release them. And I'm actually on the show's on hiatus because I will be joining the team of another podcast that comes out in a few weeks.
Yeah, I have to, full disclosure, I have a little bit of a problem with Law and Order. And I first heard you when you guested on the These Are Their Stories podcast. And I was like, I really need to listen to her podcast. And then so it seems, has this brought you into a world of podcasts in a new way? And what's that like?
Yeah, so it's kind of funny, you know, when you talk about the time, like, you know, about how we spend our time, I think that when I first started this, I just really wanted to do something with my students that was fun. And what happened, actually, it had kind of two unintended outcomes, which were really positive. The first is that as more people listen to Office Hours, it has helped me create more of a platform for some of my work in terms of helping faculty do inclusive teaching. And so some people, you know, have said to me, oh, I heard your podcast, and I get invitations to work with faculty, and I love that. And I love that I'm able to use the podcast as a starting point to do workshops about difficult dialogues or inclusive teaching. So it had this kind of professional element that was really exciting. But people who like podcasts listen to a lot of podcasts. And so, I think the first podcast I did was even before Office Hours, where I did a podcast about equity that Kansas State University does. And then I did Call Your Girlfriend, which is like a top 100 podcast. And that I only got because my best friend from college knows the people who do it. But I had an opportunity to appear there. And what was funny is after I did it, I heard from all of my students, oh my God, Professor Chatelain, I heard you on Call Your Girlfriend. That's so cool. I had no idea. Based on an Office Hours I did around the criminal justice system and some of our students who do a prison program, I got invited to do Addendum, which is a chat show that's associated with Undisclosed. Undisclosed was a podcast in response to Serial Season 1 and the wrongful conviction case in that season. Mm-hmm. And they have since created this entire platform to investigate wrongful convictions. And so they would do the episodes on Monday, and on Thursday they would have a discussion show. And it's my favorite podcast. And so when one of the producers said, would you like to join us? I was like, oh my gosh, this is the greatest thing. Because Office Hours has a very limited listenership, but Undisclosed has had 140 million downloads, just to give you a sense of the scope. And so I did two episodes of Addendum, and that's how I got to meet Rebecca Lavoie, who does the Law and Order podcast, which is just pure fun because it's such a ridiculous TV show and it's really good conversation. And then shortly after that happened, I was invited to join season 3 of Undisclosed. So we will be launching a new season of Undisclosed in March. around a criminal justice issue. And that's a 15-episode commitment. And talk about genre. So I'm used to doing a podcast where I just talk to students about stuff. And office hours, I do very little planning for. I just invite the student. I try to save the conversation for when we get in the studio so we can start talking. And it's a student I know, so I know what questions to ask them. For Undisclosed, it is investigative and scriptive. And it is very difficult. It's challenging me as a scholar to write short. People don't hear footnotes in the episodes. And so, you know, I try to make sure that my attribution is correct. And I'm part of a narrative storyteller. And so there's a team of four of us. And so I'm the historian on the team. And I'm really proud of the work that we're doing. But boy, is it difficult.
Wow, that sounds amazing and super challenging, because I think one of the things, public-facing scholarship is not something that we're necessarily encouraged to do, and yet is so important.
Yes.
So it seems to me, we've started a new initiative here at Xavier on as part of a larger core curriculum enhancement on digital humanities. And would you consider your podcast and the podcast work that you're doing digital humanities? And
I think so. I mean, I think it's this idea of bringing, you know, a discipline like history to a larger audience and helping them imagine different things that they can do with history. And so the topic of this podcast is a pretty, pretty contemporary topic, but, you know, I'm able to connect it to the 19th century or connect it to trends in the 1940s and help people understand that history is really the entry point for the origin stories of a lot of the contemporary problems that we find so daunting. So I think it's digital humanities. You know, I like to think about platforms. You know, I've written museum exhibits and, you know, I really, really engage on Twitter, and I like the idea of using my classroom assignments as a way of thinking about how to engage with these forms in order to distribute history as widely as possible.
That's really great. Can you talk a little bit more about that, like the classroom projects that you do with your students?
Yeah, one of the things I'm doing this semester is for my African-American women's history class, instead of doing we have one traditional research paper at the end, but our homework assignments, after every book, I ask students to use the knowledge from that book to solve problems that could occur in the workplace. And so some of the examples are, we just read Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl.
Okay.
They have four opportunities to use history to solve a problem. And so they pick a scenario. So one of the scenarios I presented was a ninth grade teacher is using the book and parents are upset about exposure to the history. The second one is there was Russell Simmons' production company did a joke, a like satire of Harriet Tubman, and essentially suggesting that Harriet Tubman gained her freedom because she blackmailed a slave owner about a sex tape. And it was really, really poorly received. And so I asked the students, use the knowledge that you've learned from this text to explain to people why people are upset by this, you know, why certain things are inappropriate. We just read a book about the convict labor system in Georgia and African-American women, a great book called Chained in Silence. And one of the assignments is, if a private developer wanted to redevelop the land where one of these prisons was located in the early 20th century, what are some ways to think about this choice? Or what are some ways to think about popular culture that makes references to chain gangs? You know, if you were in the position to have to market these products or decide whether the product goes through or not, how would you use history to inform your decisions? And it makes for some really interesting projects and interesting ways where students really see the practical application of the knowledge they have. And I also think it allows them to strengthen their cultural literacy skills in an age in which there is this really kind of caricaturing of academics as people who are overly sensitive. I think it's important for students to understand that outrage is actually grounded in a lot of history and a lot of masking of the past.
Right, right. Yeah, no, and I think it is so... I teach history as well. I'm a historian of the Caribbean and women. But it's so important that we teach students the applicability, right? They otherwise don't see history as anything useful to them, in their contemporary lives. Do you feel like that students are a big part of, sort of going back to the podcast, do you feel like students are a big part of your audience and they're understanding a little bit more about your perspective and how you're coming at teaching through these conversations?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, one of the most important things is that I don't need students to think I'm the smartest person in the room. I need them to think I'm the most human. Uh-huh. And so having this opportunity to talk to students kind of in the places we exist and, you know, sharing each other's stories, it's key. I mean, if you think about the content that I teach about, it's all difficult dialogue. You know, it's not like the one class period where we're doing something difficult. We're always engaged in a process that's informed by struggle and informed by so many difficult things that if we don't have any relationship or any rapport, then it just won't be successful. And so, the podcast is an opportunity for shy students to also kind of plug in. I think some students have some anxiety about talking. Regardless of the size of my class, I insist that we talk. And so for some students, their voices will never emerge. And I think that the podcast, even for the students who are afraid to come to my own office hours, it lends them an opportunity to kind of get some insights in the ways I'm thinking. And it also has some real practical application for the things that they're trying to decide, whether it's transferring or changing majors or any of the different things that I think if not put with a little insight can actually really hamper a student's success.
Yeah. So do you get a lot of letters? Because I know that on some of the episodes you answer letters. Do you get a lot of those? Or are they growing in number?
We get tweets a lot. Some of the letters we write just to fictionalize the people who are having these challenges. They're based on challenges that students have brought to us. And sometimes I think more than letters for advice, we get a lot of ideas for shows. So someone recommended next season be devoted to mentorship, where I ask people about the influential people in their lives and how they shape them. And I think that'd be a really nice way to switch up the tone. I'd like to devote a season to life after college experiences, so very specific ones, like what is it like to be in a PhD program? What is it like to go to medical school? What is it like to go to law school? For students who are discerning that pathway, I think it's really interesting to hear from people who are in the trenches in the middle of it, who aren't that far apart in age. So there's a lot of different directions. Increasingly, I just get to learn more and more about the students I teach here, but I have the network of the Truman Scholarship as well as students I meet on campuses that I visit. And so it's kind of nice. I felt like what I really liked about season two was it was students who all went to different schools. And so they are really coming at their college experience, having gone to large publics, you know, small liberal arts, just a real, the military academies, just a real diverse perspective.
Yeah, and as much as I love your Georgetown students, I love it when you talk to Howard students, because I think in many ways their experiences are enlightening for those of us teaching at HBCUs, and Xavier being a small and Catholic HBCU, so we are both same and different than the rest. Coming into, and this can either be from your students or from your own perspective, coming into the particular political challenges that we may be facing in the next 4 years, where do you see HBCUs playing a role? What do you think our challenges are going to be? I mean, it's a huge question, but it's one that I know is on everyone's minds, or everyone that is connected with HBCUs in this country, I think, is really nervous, but also wondering what we can do, you know?
So I think, and this is based on someone who has not taught at an HBCU, and so take my words of wisdom with a grain of salt. As someone who is familiar with some of the unique challenges historically of HBCUs, I think what the next 4 years are going to surface is that HBCUs are going to have their entire history come together in one moment. Meaning, I think that HBCUs are going to have to negotiate some of the relationships they did in the 19th and the first half of the 20th century about negotiating white power brokers who might have a vision of what these schools are supposed to do that might be contrary to kind of what is needed now. So there's going to be some, because of this current White House. And then they're also going to revisit, I think, a lot of the struggles that were very present in the 20s and the 60s in terms of the students really reimagining what their college education should look like. And some of the vestiges of tradition will cause, I think, tension on the campus, right? And so I think that the ways that for Black students today, because of social media, because of the world in which students are cultivated into college, their context isn't just the school they go to, it's all the schools, right? And so the ways that, for instance, students were really connected to the struggle at the University of Missouri, and so you have students at Yale holding signs, you know, Yale in solidarity with Mizzou, Howard in solidarity with Mizzou, Georgetown in solidarity with Mizzou, I think students are now thinking of themselves in kind of like a pan-student movement, if you will, and has to do with Black Lives Matter, it has to do with constant struggle, and I think depending on the environment, HBCUs are going to have to perhaps manage a student population that is acting out politically in ways that they think might actually harm their status in a number of ways, right? And so I think that that history is going to come to bear. And then I think a lot of the kind of larger questions about sexual violence and feminism, all of the things that I think all campuses deal with, the ways that those are articulated in all Black spaces for young Black women, I think will also surface a series of questions and challenges. And so I don't think that these issues are unique to historically Black colleges, but I think some of the politics of the management and the funding and the leadership, all of the history, I think, is going to come together in one moment. And, you know, the question of survival and the question of being able to thrive might feel, again, even more embattled because of these forces.
Right. And how do you think we as faculty and, you know, can best support our students as they kind of navigate through this? I mean, this is something that we're all, many of us really grapple with all the time. What are your thoughts on that?
I think just be very aware of the spaces and contexts in which they're coming from. I think that one of the things that happens is that sometimes I'll do an inclusive, you know, teaching workshop and a professor will say, well, if I had to keep up with students, you know, in order to keep up with students, rather, I would have to be on social media all day. And I'm like, well, it might be a good use of a day. You know what I mean? If it means you're spending 4 hours looking at Twitter and, you know, BuzzFeed and Blavity and Tumblr and that, and it allows you to be more successful in reaching your students, then it is time well spent. Because I don't think we can take for granted that students are entering our campuses understanding fully what they've committed to. And in light of the conversations about student debt, about the future of the economy, about where jobs are, you know, students, I don't think, are demanding consumers. I like to think of them as anxious investors. And just like we're not sure what happens when we get a mortgage and buy a house, they're not sure what the outcomes of this are supposed to be. And so I think the more that we're patient with that and we try to learn the kind of conversations and dialogues that they're having, the better that we can know what to do for them. And I think that for me, teaching them the history and teaching them the capacity of college students to really affect change and change the direction of institutions is really, really important, because I think it not only inspires them, but it also teaches them that they have more power than they can imagine.
Yeah. I think I've definitely moved from the specifics of the content to the message, right? Mm-hmm. And how change occurs and how it can occur. But it's, I think that's intersecting really interestingly with new students in the kind of ways that they put their message out there. And so I think that being attentive to that social media, to the ways in which they communicate, mm-hmm. is a huge challenge for some of us, but kind of an important one, right?
And it's also not designed for us. I mean, half of it just seems so weird. and it seems like strange and foreign to us, but I think the more and more we become conversant of it, in it, or at least curious about it. You know, what were we talking about today in class? I think we're talking about dating apps like Tinder. And I said to the students, I said, do you know what people used to do before these apps? And everyone just kind of looked at each other like blankly. And someone said, Craigslist? And I said, no, not Craigslist. And then I was teaching them about personal ads in the newspaper. Just blown. They're like, what? People did this? This is so creepy. And I said, why is that creepy? And what Tinder does is like a lot less creepy, right? And we can engage in a conversation. And again, it is not because I understand Tinder, but it's because I know it is something that is in their lives in a way that then opens up a conversation about respectability politics, that we don't have to start in 1890, that if we start in 2017 with their dating apps and we work backwards, they are now engaged in this kind of question about sexual propriety in a way they wouldn't have been before. And, you know, and then it shows in the quality of the writing and the thinking and the papers. And then, you know, 10 years later, a student says, I don't remember anything in college, but that conversation about Tinder really got me to thinking, you know, and I think we have to claim those small victories in a time that is so discouraging and so overwhelming. And every day, you know, someone says, did you hear the news? And 9 out of 10 times, it's not good news. And so I think that making the classroom a place where students can feel human is probably the most pressing need at this particular moment in our nation's history.
Yeah, no, I cannot agree more. And I do think it's about those little victories and connecting, helping students connect, you know, the present, in our case, the present to the past, but in other ways, their lives, their real IRL, right? To
yes.
Something that we're trying to teach them. I want to ask you two final questions. The first one, and they both have to do with the last question you always ask your students in your class, which I love. And so you ask them, if there was one thing that all of their professors could know about them, what would it be? And I'm wondering if you have any answers that really stood out to you or were your favorites or were kind of exemplary of what you're going for there.
Yeah, so there's an episode I did with a young woman named Alexis, and we were talking about race in the classroom, and from the perspective of a student who doesn't get involved in protests, because I think that that's the critical mass of students. It's not most of our students will not chain themselves to a bridge. Most of our students will not buy a Black Lives Matter t-shirt, and I think we often focus on those students, and we forget that there's students who are kind of trying to carve out a political identity that makes sense to them. And so I asked her, you know, what do you wish students what do you wish professors understood? And she said, you know, that when I enter a classroom, I'm coming as a Black woman. And if you could just acknowledge that, I'd be more open to learning. And she says, even if it's in a math class, if there's a way of just acknowledging that, you know, I am who I am, then I can do the learning, which I thought was really helpful. Sometimes the students surprise me and they say, I would just like to, you know, express my gratitude for all the things that my professors have done for me. And, you know, I think that's great. And then a lot of students express, like, I wish you knew how much I cared. And sometimes I can't express it. Sometimes I'm not ready to talk about something, but it doesn't mean I'm not engaged. And a lot of students, I did a talk with a student who wants to be a TV writer. And she said, you know, I sometimes wish that professors understood that we have all of these things going on in our life. Not that we don't care, it's just we have so much, and it's ours. And I think that in talking to students about the complexities of the life that they have before they get to college, it's also a nice reminder for professors to remember that they are in an evolutionary process, similar to the process we had to go through, and that if we understand that, perhaps we can be more accommodating, not just in the kind of amount of reading or the assignments, but even in our approach to what learning is going to do for them. And so I love that part of the show because I learned so much from students.
Yeah, no, it's my favorite. And I really, that resonated with me because I often tell my students, like, look, college is about making priorities. And my class doesn't have to be your first priority. You just have to acknowledge that it's there and like you're making choices. And I'm not going to be personally offended by those choices. You just have to own them. You know, and that's hard. That's a hard lesson. So what would you want all of you, if your students could know one thing about you, what would that thing be?
I think I would say how grateful I am for them. I don't think students realize just how much they do for me by just being themselves and telling me things. Mm-hmm. And the ways that I think about it, especially now, my husband and I this year just moved onto campus as faculty in residence. Mm-hmm. And so we live on campus now. And when we made this choice, everyone said, oh my God, you're going to live in a dorm with kids and it's going to be awful for your work-life balance. And what about privacy? And it has caused no problems. The students are respectful. I feel like it's better for my work-life balance because when I'm home, I'm home. And when I'm at work, I'm at work. But I don't think I could ever express what it means to be part of a community with them. After the election, I was incredibly depressed, incredibly anxious, and incredibly despondent because I saw the rise of a form of extremism that I often told students, you know, we move away from. It might shift, it might change, but we've chipped away at this edifice. And to see it rise with such clarity was heartbreaking. I mean, there's no other way to say it, but I was heartbroken after the election. And to be able to be in community with my students, to see them when I'm like throwing out my trash or to see them on the way to my car or just to know that our home is a place for them. I feel like it has saved me so many times. And I think it's a really hard thing to explain to them, like their presence has made all the difference in a very, very difficult time. And as I kind of continue throughout my career, the other thing that my husband and I have going on is we're in the process of adopting children. And I think when you're an adoptive parent, just because of the curriculum requirements, you're forced to think so much about parenting mm-hmm. in a way that perhaps other family systems don't feel like they have to have an answer because no one asks them explicitly. There's no social worker asking them questions. And in thinking about making the choice to have children, my only reference point are my students. And I think about what happens, you know, after 18 years of great parenting and wonderful support, like who they become. And so in many ways, they helped me make a very personal decision just by being such a great example of what's possible. And so I think that it's so hard to express sometimes to my students just how grateful I am to them for helping shape so many personal and professional decisions that I've made.
Well, from everything that I've heard from you through your podcasts and talking to you, I think a lot of that does certainly come through in your commitment to them. And I am going to keep listening to the podcast. I love it. And telling other people about it and my students as well, because I think they would really benefit.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else.
For more information, please visit our website at cat.xula.edu.
That's cat.xula.edu.
Until next time, keep on teaching, learning, and everything else.